tail have passed us by, they leave behind a thin trail of dust and debris. If a comet crosses the Earth's orbit, we pass through this trail each year. For example, every October 21st, we pass through the Orionid shower, which is debris left behind from Halley's Comet. This moment of science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Eric Sonstrom with help from Martin Burkhead in astronomy. I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, a person with knowledge of the deal says the Oakland Athletics have completed a trade to send outfielder Matt Holliday to the St. Louis Cardinals. The person spoke to the AP on condition of anonymity today because an announcement had yet to be made. The first-place Cardinals have been looking to add another hitter to support Albert Pujols. Holliday has struggled in his first season with the A's, batting .286 with 11 homers and 54 RBIs. The Cards open a three-game series tonight in Philadelphia. They're holding a one-and-a-half-game lead in the National League Central. Joel Piniero will be on the Cardinals starter, will be the Cardinals starter against J.A. Happ of the Phillies. The Chicago Cubs are trying to build on the momentum of a successful road trip as they open a homestand this afternoon against Cincinnati. Randy Wells is on the mound at Wrigley Field against struggling Reds ace Aaron Harang. And that game in the top of the fourth was tied at 3-3. The Cubs, meanwhile, have scratched Ted Lilly from his start tomorrow against Cincinnati because of shoulder soreness. The team announced the move today when the left-hander was scheduled to undergo tests to determine the extent of the injury. Kevin Hart will get the start for the Cubs tomorrow. First place in the American League Central is on the line today in Detroit, where the Chicago White Sox play the Detroit Tigers in a day-night doubleheader. The two teams are tied thanks to Mark Burley's perfect game against Tampa Bay and Detroit's loss to Seattle yesterday. In the first game of that doubleheader, in the bottom of the eighth, Detroit leads the Sox 5-1. That's sports.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square. Starting as one of the nation's first enclosed malls, Lincoln Square is now evolved into a mixed-use lifestyle center. Information on business space and future development projects is available at 217-367-4092.
This Week in This American Life, Pete's parents fell in love in World War II. Years later, when his mom died, she was supposed to get a free burial as a vet. But there's tricky fine print. His dad was told this is a $16 fee and kind of goes nuts.
He's going on and on about this, and finally it's like, well, okay, you know, I understand your point of view and it was supposed to be free, but, where's mom?
Stories of getting tripped up by the fine print. That's this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6.
Next week marks 6 months since Pat Quinn took over as Illinois' governor. Quinn was welcomed into the job by longtime friends and even some longtime critics as a breath of fresh air. But the honeymoon ended quickly, and the recent budget battle has left scars heading into a potentially tough election season. Sam Hudzik reports.
Pat Quinn's resume of populist activism in and out of elected office spans 4 decades, but his legacy will no doubt be marked by this moment on January 29th.
I now pronounce the judgment of conviction against Radar Blagojevich, thereby removing him from the office of governor, effective immediately.
Minutes later, Quinn was sworn in before the legislature as Illinois' 41st governor.
Now it's our job to call upon the people of Illinois to make the sacrifices necessary to address the serious challenges that we have before us. The integrity challenge, the challenge of our economy, the challenge of making sure that we pay our bills.
By all accounts, those goals have not been met, and the budget debate that began then, and to some extent still continues, quickly strained the new governor's relationship with the legislature.
Well, you know what? We appreciate the fact that he was brought in by us, by our votes, kind of halfway through the budget process. He's an honest guy. He's working hard. he's better than the last guy.
That's Senate President John Cullerton earlier this month after Quinn vetoed an early version of the budget. The governor's efforts to convince lawmakers to raise the income tax had come up short, a failure Cullerton explains in part by Quinn's past as an activist and an outsider.
He's never really worked with the legislature. He's worked against the legislature historically. So he's got to understand what it takes for people to come around and vote.
Cullerton and others have also complained that Quinn kept changing his mind during the budget debate. Quinn dismisses that charge, saying those so-called flip-flops are actually compromises to achieve, quote, the common good. Compromises that some Quinn supporters are now having a hard time stomaching.
Well, everyone knows the context under which Pat Quinn took office.
Anders Lindahl is spokesman for AFSCME Council 31, a union representing about 40,000 state workers. Lindahl says Quinn was right for pushing for a tax increase, but he says Quinn was wrong for eventually signing a budget that doesn't provide that revenue.
Pat Quinn's threat to lay off thousands of state employees who provide essential human services and public safety functions is profoundly disappointing, and it is grossly irresponsible.
Quinn also wants state workers to take unpaid days off, forego a pay increase, and agree to reduced pensions for new employees. Not exactly an agenda designed to keep happy a union that's donated about $80,000 to his campaign in recent years. It's worth noting here that in the past 6 months, AFSCME gave $5,000 to Quinn's campaign, while giving five times as much to his possible primary opponent, Controller Dan Hynes. That's according to campaign finance reports filed this week in the same database where I found other longtime supporters of Pat Quinn.
My name is Vic Smith.
Park Ridge resident Vic Smith made about a dozen donations, a few hundred dollars at a time, to Quinn's campaign in the past decade.
Primarily because I thought he was dedicated and honest and forthright.
And while he's not too pleased about Quinn's push for a tax hike, Smith believes the governor's doing what he can in a tough situation.
We're in uncharted waters, so I think he's not going to be going forward without a misstep here or there. And I think you have to go with the gal you brought to the dance with, okay? Because who's better out there? Who's more qualified than he is?
As for Governor Quinn himself, he's not interested in self-assessment at this point. I asked him a week ago what mistakes he'd made in the past 6 months and what he'd learned from them.
I'd have to take a little bit of time to come up with a laundry list of mistakes.
Quinn asked for a week to think about it. So yesterday, I asked him again.
Yeah, that's your favorite question. Well, I thought and thought in the last week, and I know maybe I need another month or so. I come up with that. Yeah. You know, I'm sure all of us are fallible. Don't get me wrong. I make mistakes. But I don't think I spend a lot of time looking at my navel saying, what mistakes have I made today?
Quinn says it's his job to be optimistic and to, quote, carry out the duties of the office the best I can. I'm Sam Hudzik.
The University of Illinois's admissions policies are under the microscope, and on Monday, the State Commission investigating irregularities in the system will visit the Urbana campus for the first time. The commission will hear from current U of I President Joseph White and past presidents James Stuckel and Stanley Eikenberry. AM 580 will air the hearing live Monday morning at 10:30 after analysis of the scandal on Focus 580 at 10. Live coverage of the Illinois Admissions Review Commission Monday morning at 10 on AM 580. The Obama administration is today announcing details of a plan to give out billions of dollars in stimulus funds to help school districts turn around failing schools. There's a belief among many school reformers that the best way to do this is to close the schools and reopen them with an entirely new staff. But as Beth Furtick of member station WNYC in New York City reports, some school districts are looking into less drastic alternatives.
Principal Ted Husted knew he was facing huge challenges when he took over Public School 85 in the Bronx 3 years ago. The school was chronically failing. Only 4 out of 10 of its elementary students were reading on grade level. And Husted discovered student behavior problems were so bad, the kids couldn't even handle a new recess period.
The injury rate in our clinic, in our health clinic at lunchtime, went through the roof because kids weren't used to having that space and they weren't used to getting out. and just running and playing.
Husted hired a nonprofit group that confirmed there was a link between student behavior and achievement.
One child tantruming in a kindergarten class of a second-year teacher can effectively derail instruction not only for that day, but possibly for a whole year.
Greg Grecius is a senior vice president with Turnaround for Children, which specializes in helping low-performing schools. The organization's approach differs from those that start by overhauling the staff at failing schools. Turnaround for Children looks at how academic issues and social and emotional factors can interrupt learning. Grecius says these problems are common in low-income neighborhoods like the Bronx.
The critical issue is being able to separate out which ones really are the highest need kids, which ones really need mental health services, which ones need support from a social service organization, which ones' parents need housing, which ones need help from an immigration lawyer.
At PS85, coaches created an intervention team and taught the school how to sort out which students needed what kind of help and how to link them to local providers. The program also worked with teachers on classroom management. The total cost was about $300,000, a third of which was funded by the school by hiring a full-time social worker. The rest came from private and public funding. The turnaround happened quickly. This year, 49% of students met state standards for reading, a 13-point gain over last year, and almost three-quarters met the standards for math. Second-grade teacher Mario Palma sees the difference.
It's so amazing to see what can be done once you get all that behavior stuff out of the way.
Palma is in his second year of teaching. He says he's managing his classroom better with approaches he learned from Turnaround for Children.
Maybe acknowledging someone who's distracted by bringing their body into close proximity with the student as opposed to even speaking to them, using signals to get their attention, having certain hand movements so that they know when it's time to move.
Turnaround for Children has had similar results in other schools. The American Institutes for Research found test scores went up and fewer students were suspended at six middle schools in the Bronx that used the program. Scores continued improving over the next 3 years, but one school dropped out. The Obama administration acknowledges programs like these that work with low-performing schools can get results. But U.S. Department of Education spokesman Peter Cunningham says they can't waste time.
Kids need a change right away when they're in a failing school. Not over time, not the slow and steady improvement process. You need a real break in culture. We think it's possible to do it with the existing staff. We think it's very hard, but we've completely allowed for that model.
And with as many as 5,000 schools at risk of being closed under provisions of the No Child Left Behind law, Cunningham says there just aren't enough experienced teachers and principals to overhaul every school. Turnaround for Children is planning to expand its efforts inside and outside New York City. Meanwhile, a research group called Mass Insight is planning to work with partners around the country to see if these kinds of reforms can help failing schools without shutting them down. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
For the first time in decades, the Southern Baptist Convention is losing members. It lost former President Jimmy Carter 9 years ago. Recently, Mr. Carter wrote that a big reason for leaving was the convention's treatment of women. The Southern Baptist Convention says women cannot hold positions of leadership over men. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
A few years ago, when Julie Pennington Russell showed up for her first Sunday as pastor at Calvary Baptist Church in Waco, Texas, she was greeted by a crowd of protesters.
I was walking through the picket line with my son, Taylor, who was 7 at the time. All of a sudden, he squeezed my hand and pulled me down, and I heard him say, "Mom, who is Jezebel, and why are they calling you that?"
The protesters were from other Baptist churches that disapproved of Calvary calling a woman as senior pastor. Baptist churches are independent and can hire anyone they want, but if they hire a woman, they run the risk of being disfellowshipped or kicked out of the Southern Baptist Convention. Richard Land, a senior officer of the SBC, says the reason is simple.
We believe that the Bible says that while both men and women are gifted for service in the church, the office of pastor is limited to men as qualified by Scripture.
Land is referring to the writings of the Apostle Paul, who said women should not have authority over men in the church or the home. The Baptist reaffirmed that teaching in 2000. But Wade Burleson, who pastors a Southern Baptist megachurch in Enid, Oklahoma, believes the leaders got it wrong.
That is not what God says. You are badly misinterpreting the Word of God. And the consequences of your misinterpretation are enormous.
Burleson says Jesus treated women as equals, and if Southern Baptists ignore his example, the denomination will die. Burleson believes there's an underground movement within the convention to rethink women's roles.
No.
Richard Land says Burleson is dreaming. He says Southern Baptists are united. Of their 44,000 churches, fewer than 100 have women leaders. Land concedes they've lost members in recent years, but he says tacking leftward is not the answer.
Those people who are saying, well, we need to broaden and we need to be more accepting of divergent views, those are the same people who have led the mainline denominations to death's door.
In fact, there's some evidence of a conservative crackdown. Consider the case of Sherry Clauda, who taught Hebrew at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Dallas. All was well until 2003, when Paige Patterson, a former president of the SBC, arrived to run the seminary.
I was told that I would not be considered for tenure because I was a woman and because he believed that women should not be teaching theology to men.
Clauda found another teaching job at a non-Baptist university. In the meantime, Southwestern has developed a new track for women seminarians, which includes homemaking and homeschooling. Albert Moeller, president of Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, acknowledges they're going against culture.
Ultimately, I'm not so fearful that the times will judge us as I'm aware that God will judge us. And I hope with all my heart that he will find our churches faithful to his word.
Still, Pastor Wade Burleson hopes the days of disparate treatment of women are numbered.
I'm not a betting Baptist, but if I were, I would put money on the table that 50 years from now, Southern Baptists will look at women and the role of women the way we now look at slavery.
Until that happens, Southern Baptist women can be spiritual leaders to other women or children, anyone but men. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Earth and sky.
We are undergoing an unprecedented extinction event in our time right now, where amphibians, many populations throughout the world are disappearing.
That's ecologist Andrew Blaustein. He told us that scientists have recently learned more about diseases that might be killing millions of frogs and other amphibians.
And one of them is this thing called a chytrid fungus, which is a fungus that wasn't really well known until about 10 years ago, and it seems to be correlated with many of the amphibian declines, especially in the tropics.
Although the chytrid fungus and other diseases can spread naturally among frogs, Blaustein noted that human destruction of their habitat is also to blame.
It could trigger a stress response. Just like people, frogs can get diseases when they're stressed.
Frogs eat a lot of mosquitoes and flies, so if frogs were to disappear entirely, Blaustein said, we humans would feel the consequences.
We would have a heck of a lot more insect pests around.
And Blaustein noted frogs are also important sources of new medicines.
Frogs are often hopping pharmaceutical systems. They have so many antibacterial